your dreams and shattered lines. Sci-fi whispers lost to time.
And the fun begins.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 3 of My Internet Has Stopped Working, brought to you by the Podcasters of the Apocalypse.
This is appropriate because this book is about
apocalypse. This is very apocalyptic. Today we are looking at The Peripheral by William Gibson, written in 2014. So let's first go around and introduce ourselves and your first contact. When did you first find out, hear, read, or experience this book in any capacity?
I've been expecting you. Oh, forgive me. We haven't been formally introduced, have we?
I will begin, because I always do. Justin Jackpot Marquis. And I brought this book to the attention of the group. I first experienced Gibson probably 20 years ago. I read Neuromancer. I read The Peripheral probably 10 years ago. Yeah, that'd be probably right after it came out. I have my well-worn copy sitting here. And I'm a big William Gibson fan, so I've also watched the series, like this stuff.
Nice. I'm Haptics Harmon over here. I was not familiar with William Gibson at all, and introduced to both the idea that the book existed and that there's also an accompanying show around the same time, so you know, a couple months ago. Really, really enjoyed it. Felt like I needed to have both in tandem to really understand what was going on, but more about that later.
I'm Wheelie Boy Natalie. But actually, when I was reading the book, that was like the most distinct thing. It was like the Wheelie Boy getting... Anyway, Wheelie Boy Natalie, Britt,
and Justin showed me the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just like a month ago, I guess.
So I am Rena Lobier, and very new to William Gibson. Had seen the advertisements for, you know, when it first came to Prime, I had seen that, and being a sci-fi fan, it looked very interesting. So, but sometimes feeling stung, like if you start with the visual, the series or the movie first, you get tainted or predisposed to look at the characters a certain way as opposed to reading the book first. But for this one, actually, I found them both. It's same as you. First time hearing about William Gibson, and then also just having to have them in tandem to try to make sense of the technology. A little hard to follow at times in book.
Peripheral Liz Davis over here learned about the book on July 17th. My first day with the instructional design team.
Sweet. Nice. I love the specificity.
That's very specific. What time?
For posterity, she notes July 17th.
Probably 10:42.
Okay. Oh. Also very specific.
We would have thrown that at her early and, like, join the podcast. Let's go.
Exactly.
If everything's ready here on the dark side of the moon, play the 5 tones.
Okay, so no dust jacket.
Not on the version we all shared.
But we could say that there is a quote on the cover.
Yeah, you can read that quote, Brie.
Spectacular. A piece of trenchant, far future speculation that features all the eyeball kicks of Neuromancer and all the maturity and slywood of Spook Country. It's brilliant. Corey Doctorow. And that's referencing two other Gibson novels.
Mm.
So... unless you've read those, you're probably not thinking that's a really descriptive quote, but whatever.
I don't know. Eye kick is pretty descriptive.
I know. Which, I mean...
kind of is.
It is.
First of all, it was October. A rare month for boys. Full of cold winds, long nights, dark promises. Days get short. The shadows lengthen. The wind mourns in such a way you want to run forever through the fields.
First phase here,
yes,
is to talk about the man himself. So if you were here for the Philip K. Dick episode of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, Zach set the bar very high. So I've got this whole bio on Gibson to read to you.
Oh, yeah.
About him, and I have...
let's hope he's better than Philip K. Dick.
He's way better than Philip K. Dick. So William Ford Gibson was born March 17th, 1948, is an American-Canadian speculative fiction writer, which I think is very appropriate for what he does. An essayist widely credited with pioneering the science fiction subgenre known as cyberpunk. Beginning his writing career in the late 1970s, his early works were noir, near-future stories that explored the effects of technology, cybernetics, and computer networks on humans, a combination of low-life and high-tech, and helped to create an iconography for the information age before the ubiquity of the internet in the 1990s. Gibson coined the term cyberspace for widespread interconnected digital technology in his short story, Ooh. Burning Chrome, 1982, and later popularized the concept in his acclaimed debut novel, Neuromancer. Brief excerpt from Billy Idol's cyberpunk album, which is based almost entirely on Neuromancer from 1984. So these early works of Gibson's have been credited with renovating science fiction literature in the 1980s. In 1999, The Guardian described Gibson as probably the most important novelist of the past two decades, while the Sydney Morning Herald called him the noir prophet of cyberpunk. Throughout his career, Gibson has written more than 20 short stories and 12 critically acclaimed novels, one in collaboration, contributed articles to several major publications, and collaborated extensively with performance artists, filmmakers, and musicians. More of that in the David Bowie section. His work has been cited as influencing a variety of disciplines: academia, design, film, literature, music, cyberculture, and technology. He was born in 1948 in Conway, South Carolina. Seminal figure in science fiction, particularly known for pioneering cyberpunk genre. I feel like this is redundant, so I'm going to skip most of his early life. He did move to Canada in 1967 to avoid the draft for the Vietnam War, settled in Toronto, later moved to Vancouver, out here, where he completed a Bachelor's of Arts degree at the University of BC in 1977. His writing career began in the late 1970s with short stories that explored the intersection of technology and society. His debut novel, Neuromancer, introduced the term cyberspace and became a cornerstone of cyberpunk literature. This novel, along with Count Zero and Mona Lisa Overdrive, 1988, formed the influential Sprawl trilogy. Neuromancer follows the story of Henry Case, a washed-up hacker hired for one last job, which brings him into contact with a powerful artificial intelligence. So he was also pioneering AI in the 80s.
Wow.
Late 70s, 80s.
I just can't get over it how he's the noir prophet of cyberpunk.
He is.
I'd put that on a shirt. Yep. Like, wear that everywhere. What is your job title?
Noir prophet.
Noir prophet.
I have to say, Neuromancer is my gamer tag. So.
Oh.
Fun stuff.
It's very nerdy.
Yes, incredibly nerdy. Don't see a lot of it. So that is that first phase about the man himself. Just really, for me, I don't even know, really remember how I got on to Neuromancer. It was that long ago. But it was one of those books, and the reason I recommended Gibson is because when I first read Neuromancer, I did not understand it. Like, I didn't get it. I couldn't picture what was happening. It was that out there, like that cutting edge, that deep. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's a criticism/feature of Gibson, he's super lean with his language. So he doesn't say any extra anything. So he doesn't waste a ton of time in descriptive. So for me, when I first read his stuff, it was just immerse in it. Just go into it. Just sink yourself into it. Eventually, you build up enough understanding of what's happening that you feel it, you get it. But like Neuromancer, I just felt it. The same thing with Peripheral. And as we talked about Peripheral, I did recommend the series to some of you because I had, of course, read it. Then I watched the series, which is significantly diverges, to use some Gibson terminology, diverges from the book, but in a way that there's enough of the book in that series that it really painted a picture. Mm-hmm. And the second time I read this book, just recently, I was like, oh my God, I know exactly. I have the images for it, because that's what he lacks in a lot of his writing, is the imagery of it. You've got the feel, you've got the sense of being there, but you're left to fill in a lot of the blanks yourself. And I mean, watched it.
I love those. Like, a lot of times if there's too much description, I'm like, earlier I was picturing someone else, mm-hmm. which is my problem with like watching movies made out of books. I'm like, that's not, they didn't do it right. Mm-hmm. So this one, I'm a little bit afraid to watch the series because I, like, even from the beginning, like, at the very beginning when she's patrolling the game.
You got your own pictures.
I have my own picture. Yeah,
and he leaves space for that, which is really nice. Yeah. We'll talk about the series later because, frankly, I think it's one of the most brilliant science fiction series that I have seen.
This is the world that you know. The world as it was at the end of the 20th century. It exists now only as part of a neural interactive simulation that we call the Matrix.
So the plot of the book is next, and this is really a simple book. It's a hard-boiled detective story set in a future. It's about a future murder, but the witness is from the past, and a past close to us, not quite us. And it shifts back and forth between those two time periods as the characters come in to meet each other, one of our near future and the other about 70 years later, after this catastrophic global event called the Jackpot, which is actually a series of events. And I think this is one of those places where you can see Gibson's brilliance. I feel like we're right in the jackpot, early jackpot, maybe even deep jackpot in our own society right now. And I think he's hit that 10 years ago. He hit it pretty much out of the park in terms of hitting that. So you start to see them as they start interacting through their peripherals, which are creatures, beings, bodies, which people can inhabit in different times, along with Natalie's namesake, the iPad on a stick, the Wheelie Boy.
Wheelie Boy.
To interact with people. So we're going to talk about the technology later, but I think that's really pretty simple book without giving away a whole lot of the plot. It's basically figure out who killed this girl in this tower with who knows what. The witness is somebody from 70 years earlier in the past, which is a fascinating tenet.
Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
We now go into heroes and villains, and there's plenty of characters in here. Anybody want to start? I've spoken way too much.
In the overview plot of the book, you didn't mention any of the characters.
You want me to listen to the characters?
Yeah.
So we have this... Do you want to? You seem
no.
To?
No.
I'll bring up the first one that would be listed. The first person that pops into my head is Lev.
Oh.
Now, and I know...
Lev Zubov.
Lev Zubov is a much more, I don't know if this is the right word, sympathetic character in the book, and a lot scarier in the series. Which is why, actually, when I was reading the book and then started watching the series, I was...
You had a mismatch.
I was like, who is this character? He's fucking terrifying. Very, very mafioso. Hitman vibes.
Yeah, in the book, he's kind of like...
Yeah.
Dad vibes.
Yeah.
Like, kind of like, is this what we're going to do? Oh, cool. Let's do this.
He's a facilitator.
Yeah. But there is a Russian accent, there are vague accents in the audiobook version of this book that I can't decide whether or not they're, you know, it just, I'm like, should I be offended? Should I not?
Yeah.
Because there's also a character of nondescript Asian character, and there's definitely a quote-unquote Asian accent being used in the audiobook version.
Well, let me lay out some of the characters then. How's that?
Yeah, do it.
Okay, so we've got Flynn.
Yes.
Flynn Fisher and her brother, Burton, is her older brother. He's a Marine Corps vet with these haptic implants.
So cool.
They're both basically in this future, and this is when I love the scale of the money. Like, they have a mom who has cancer, I believe, and she's ill. So they are basically gamers for hire to make money to support their mom's need for her cancer treatments. And Burton has been tasked with a job from the shadowy corporation in Colombia to basically be on patrol in a drone, and he is unavailable to go to work one day, so he taps Flynn, who, of course, witnesses the murder of Deidre West, who is a celebrity artist. She's Wilf Netherton's ex-girlfriend, significant other. Mm-hmm. Have I got him right? You're looking at me like I'm crazy.
Isn't it Deidre's sister?
Alita?
Yeah. Alita's the one who gets murdered.
Oh, Alita gets murdered.
Yeah.
Alita gets murdered. Deidre's her sister.
That's important.
It is important. You got to get the details somewhere. Yeah. Right. Flynn has witnessed the murder while working for Burton, and then it becomes the mystery around that. So they get contacted. They've been contacted because they are on patrol. The game that they're playing is actually in the future, and it's real life. They're remotely piloting drones into the future to basically keep the paparazzi off of Alita as she is in her tower preparing for a public appearance. And she is murdered pretty graphically and dramatically. We don't know by whom then. And then, gosh.
Well, we know who. We just don't know who they are.
Yes, she saw the person. We just have no idea who the person was.
Yeah.
And we won't learn that until the very end of the book.
Very, very end.
The very, very end. Which is one of my criticisms of the book, but we'll get there. So in the process of that, the book gets really big to try and solve this mystery. Is basically people from the future are funneling money back to the past to help keep Burton and Flynn alive, while the people responsible for doing the murder are trying to kill them in our present or their present. So it gets very complicated, and there's all this interplay between people like Wilf and Lobeer, who's the police detective. Wilf is the publicist slash Alita's, Deidre's ex. Then there's all the people in the present who work around and with Flynn, Madison and Janice, Connor, who's a fascinating character, a disabled vet who has basically not much left of him, no legs, one arm, rides a kind of interesting motorcycle thing. And then Reese, there's more buddies around that. And of course, Lev Zubov is facilitating a lot of what's happening in the future. Character Britt talked about. Mm-hmm. He's a rich Russian oligarch, and it seems as if in this world there are factions set up. There's the oligarchs who rule much of the world. There's the police who rule much of the world. And then there's a couple other factions as well while ruling the
all
world.
Right.
And they're all allied in strange ways. Mm-hmm. All right, is that more of the characters? Enough to get us going? Okay, heroes. Anybody want to nominate a hero?
Flynn.
Flynn's clearly the hero. Yeah. The heroine.
Heroine.
Yep.
I was going to go with Officer Johnny.
Officer Johnny? Tommy.
I was going to say Madison.
Oh.
He's a hero.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Because he kind of just is like, yeah, I'm going to do this. But he also pumps the brakes on a lot of ethical things.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah. And they're the fabricators, right?
Yeah. Not builders, fabricators.
How about
important distinction?
How about Lobeer? And don't let the series color you in your assessment of Lobeer as a hero or villain, or Zubov as a hero or villain. And I think for me, one of the challenges around this book is we have no idea why they hired somebody from the past. Like that is the great mystery of this that definitely becomes clear in the series. But I think it's not clear in the book. Like, why did they have to hire somebody in the past to patrol this building to keep the paparazzi away?
I didn't understand.
And that's this place where there's a disconnect in the plot of the book that definitely gets ironed out. And I just started the Agency, which is the sequel to this book, but I'm not far enough to tell you if that comes to pass yet. So there's this disconnect. So we don't really know, I think, in this book.
I have ideas, because I haven't seen this show yet. My thoughts are, after the jackpot, there were just weren't a lot of people. Fair and enough. So it was simply a supply and demand issue. Mm-hmm. There were more people to hire.
Cheap labor, too. Yeah,
exactly.
I also think, and Wilf kind of touches on this, of like how basically, because there's not a lot of people, everyone's in everyone's business. Mm-hmm. And so if you have someone... And you don't actually know because they might be in a peripheral body and you're not sure. And, like, what if they're going to pass information off? So that's kind of why I assumed, like, security reasons.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
I wonder, too, if it may be a cover-up, cover-your-tracks kind of thing. Because they talk about the stump.
Stump, excuse me.
Yeah. This divergence, you know, this place where they can go. And maybe by having somebody going back, if they can manipulate that trail or that vein of
reality,
new reality, a new branch, that
maybe that's easier to cover up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Makes me wonder how many steps there are.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to go into the science because that's where I love the science.
Yeah. Oh, wait, but first we have to talk about the other villain, yeah. Corbell Pickett.
Yeah, Pickett. Oh, yeah. Definitely a villain.
Definitely a villain.
Definitely a villain. You want to explain Pickett a little bit? So I'm glossed over.
Pickett is like the local town in the stub. Mm-hmm. So in the stub, in that time vortex, and Corbell Pickett is kind of the evil ringleader who's kind of taken over the economy in this town.
He's a cartel boss.
Yeah, he's a cartel boss. Mm-hmm. Who took over, I mean, it depends. So the book doesn't cover this, but in the show, he kills a biker gang in order to take over the town and kind of paints himself as a savior. And that he's cleaning up the town and making it a safer place, when in fact, he's just selling drugs and murdering people who don't listen to him, just like the other people. But in a collared shirt and slacks. So, yeah, his character is pretty scary.
And he ends up working as the agent to partially to try and get rid of Burton and Flynn,
yes,
in their time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like the way the show handled that a bit. But, Corbell Pickett is, I think he's one of the characters that doesn't have a lot of, he's not very 3D to me. He's just evil.
Mm-hmm.
And he's calculating. Mm-hmm. He's doing things for money. He doesn't even really care about his family, obviously.
Yeah. I think he's much less prominent in the book than in the series.
Yes.
But, yeah. How about Lev and Ossian and Ash, those people who, if you don't think about the series, but you think more about the book, they're just kind of neutral facilitators, like, as far as we know.
Like chaotic neutral. They're not totally neutral in my book.
I feel like Ainsley, she's the one.
Lobier, yeah. She's the cop. Oh, Ainsley is
not Ainsley. I'm thinking about
Ash.
Yeah.
The one who speaks bird. Or that's how it was in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, they make up languages.
Yeah. They like automatically translate.
I think that she is like an unsung hero because she's like trying.
Mm-hmm.
To, especially when she brings Wilf in and is like, okay, I'm going to let you understand what I'm saying for just a quick second. Mm-hmm. But, like, I think it's, like, it shows that, like, even people who are in the know don't even know everything that's going on. It's, like, really fragmented in the society of, like, who knows what information about what's going on.
Information is clearly power.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Lobier, we're going to assume the best intentions based on what we know from the book. Without speculative fictioning her. So
she seemed like a villain, but I don't think she was.
She does do some seemingly villainous things, but does seem to be a person who facilitates things. And I actually have a quote about her that I saved that I think will tell us that in the book, at least, she is the intention is that, or at least people think she's good. And then we have the two. Spoiler alert.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger. No, Will Robinson. Danger.
Two people who show up at the end who are the villains, the murderers, Sir Henry, the Remembrancer, and Al-Habib, who is the boss patcher from that weird floating garbage patch in the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah. Which is just so real.
I think there's not a lot of coloring to them. They are bad. They killed her. I don't even remember why they killed her.
Because she was trying to sell the garbage patch, I thought.
Yeah, but then also her sister is also in on it.
Right, Deidre.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah,
which Deidre I didn't like from the beginning anyway.
Yeah.
She seems like a vapid narcissistic woman.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and I think...
Rich daddy.
Oh, right.
I think like most noir, it's pretty straightforward who the heroes and the villains are. You end up with an orbit of people around Flynn and Burton who are helping them, so would be good, theoretically, since they witnessed the murder and are trying to deal with the fallout of the murder. And then you have the people who did the murder slash are responsible for the bad things. So I desperately want to talk about the series, but we might have to do a separate episode on the series.
It's honestly, it's so intertwined, it has to be sprinkled in. But I think we should deep dive into the series for sure, because I have not finished it.
Okay,
so I should deep dive later, but...
Let's do a second episode on the series as a follow-up, just because it's
It is so super good.
All right. Anything else you want to say about the heroes and villains?
Yeah, well, I told the captain I'd have this analysis done in an hour.
How long would it really take? An hour? Oh, you didn't tell him how long it would really take, did you?
Well, of course I did.
Oh, laddie, you've got a lot to learn if you want people to think of you as a miracle worker.
Tech.
So much tech.
This is where I think Gibson makes his money, in that he really sees where we're at, and he hypothesizes. He's a speculative fiction guy. He zeroes in on things that are really, really potential and accurate. The first, of course, being time travel. And I think this is what everything I read about this is one of the most unique but plausible depictions of time travel that people have seen. Anybody want to explain how time travel works in this?
It's data transfer.
It is
being in a time based upon the type of data that you are absorbing, inputting at any given moment. And that's...
There's a secret server in China that is connected to our past, the data stream of our time.
Which means it is in the past.
It is.
And you jump in the flow.
And honestly, if you think about things like wormhole travel, which we went all round and round on, on the Newitz novel, data is one of the things, because it lacks mass, it is something that can actually travel at near light speeds or fast enough to move back and forth across different times, which is fascinating that he hit it right. So they can actually transfer data fast enough between times that they could make this happen. What I love is its string theory. It's because the moment contact is made with a specific time, it diverges into a new time. So it handily averts the time travel paradox. Because, of course, the time travel paradox would be, if I were to contact Liz yesterday, or if I were to go back in time and kill somebody before they were born, not Liz, anybody else, then if I killed my parent before they were born, I couldn't exist, so I couldn't kill them. So you end up with that paradox. But this basically branches the past.
Yes.
So that there's two different branches, two different stubs, and you can end up having different tracks of time, which theoretically is the way that physics works, speculatively. Anyway. So I think that was a really handy, fascinating piece.
I think, like, part of it also, just for, like, a good visual of kind of what I was thinking, is in Avatar, when they go into their bodies, like, your body is still functioning on its own. So you're not physically,
right there.
It's data transfer.
Yep.
So you have to come back and eat. You have to come back and go to the bathroom.
Yep.
Unless you're, like, Connor and get a catheter put in.
Yep. So that's the peripherals. That's the other piece of tech. Is that these soul, we don't know what they are, cyborgs, humans, soulless human things.
I feel like robots with
human skin.
Human skin.
Yeah. Cyborg.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they don't have their own consciousness unless someone is inhabiting them.
Right.
Yeah. Outside of that, they're functioning on AI.
Yeah.
On They're remote. They run on autopilot.
Which I found really interesting in a separate conversation that I was having, is people were using the terms peripheral and auxiliary interchangeably. And this book very clearly defines the difference between those.
The wheelie boy was the auxiliary, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a non-body entity.
It doesn't have humanoid features. Right. Okay. Cheaper, theoretically.
Way cheaper. iPad on a stick.
They never get into it, but I was also wondering, and I mean, this gets more into, like, the ethics of AI, but specifically with the peripheral that Connor inhabits, that AI has its own personality. And, like,
that's
very much
one,
so,
right?
Yeah, is, like, I would say leaning more on, if we're going to go back to Terraformers, like, I'd say he's considered a person. And so Connor coming in to inhabit his body was a little bit, iffy for me. Whereas with
possession.
Flynn, right, with Flynn, that peripheral was literally, like, go
made
there.
For her. Yeah.
Yeah, do this.
Interesting.
And there was nothing going on, right?
Never.
So that was a little bit iffy for me.
Person.
Yeah, they're definitely some interesting ethics that I don't know that Gibson dives into at all. Like, it's just, this is the world, this is what it is, and he doesn't make any judgment. He just paints this picture, and you're in it, and you don't, they don't wrestle with those issues.
Even
the junk patch.
The junk patch, I know, that was, they don't wrestle with it, but the fact that it really exists in our stuff is disturbing.
Yeah. And why don't you explain the junk patch for anybody who hasn't read the book?
So, the junk patch is just, it's the accumulation of massive quantities of trash in the ocean, and Gibson, through this book, kind of theorized that at one point it would become so large that it could be inhabited by people. Mm-hmm. So it became essentially property to be sold, like real estate, which is how this comes about, that, you know, Alita ultimately gets murdered because she's trying to broker a sale of this and is upsetting some people. So the...
And of course it's trash, so it's contaminated and toxic, and the people who are all there are cancerous and deformed, and it's just a mess.
The have-nots of this futuristic world.
But again, no ethical judgment at all in any of the description of that.
No, it's very neutral. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to touch on something you kind of brought up peripherally, pun intended. The technology in this book, when I started reading it, it felt very present because it's not very far out of our future, but futuristic enough to where I was confused by the technology. So that's what made it seem very futuristic to me, that, you know, it was talking about something that we all know, like a trailer, you know, those streamlined trailers, but it was filled with like some sort of foam, this like biofoam gel that like makes things clean. You have to like spray it out and stuff like that, which wasn't depicted as much in the show, but the biofoam piece and stuff like that. But, you know, the fact that it was future adjacent but futuristic enough to truly feel like it could be, you know, 15 years in our future, which I think is when it is. Kind of very disturbing. And I did read some articles about Gibson and these books that he purposefully doesn't let you have too much information and makes you feel in so that you feel disconcerted and confused, because that's how you would feel being exposed to this future when you're going into the, you know, going into what you think is a sim and you realize that it's real. Mm-hmm. So I have not really read a book where I felt like, you know, I felt like Flynn. That was very meta.
Some other technology is the drugs.
Yeah.
What was it called?
The Medicis.
Yeah. The Medicis. But what about the other one that was something, the one that they were giving to people? It's like crazy something, party drug. What is it called?
I know what you're talking about, but it's not in my head. It's the end of the book.
Yeah. But it was like to create a dissociative state in you, and
and if you get Wolf too was much happy, of it,
it's it's the name of a chapter. The chapter names were hilarious. Okay,
I just looked it up, and all I'm getting is, do you need help?
There's not a lot of information on party time. Yeah, but they were going to give to the religious group, the Luke 4-5.
Yeah, weird drug.
And the aunties. Which is AI. Like, there's a quote in there that says, algorithms are called the aunties. They're self-organizing, and so nobody truly understands them. So these aunties that are predicting, understanding, kind of running the show for the government, it's an AI. We've got an AI running
called the
show.
Aunties. I love that they're women.
The aunties, yes. The Michikoids, there's a bunch of female robots running around. The Patchers, the ones who live on the garbage patch. The jackpot. Do we need to talk about the jackpot in more detail?
Yeah. That's the part that's been giving me nightmares. I think we brought this up offline, that reading this book and watching this show is giving me like future post-apocalyptic nightmares.
Near future
nightmares. I'm like, I wonder how much bulletproof windows cost. You know, weird things like that. You know, you're wondering about what, it starts out with like a great blackout. of the you know, the power grids in the
but
United
not
States.
Just that. It starts out with a pandemic.
Yep.
Yeah. And
literally
yeah,
just
it feels
happened.
Like we're
and
in
this
the
show jet, came out in 2020.
Oh.
Right when the pandemic started. I can't remember the exact time it started or had just started,
yeah.
But obviously they had already produced the entire first season. They didn't know the pandemic was going to start. That is freaking creepy.
He's prophetic, as you said in the lead up here.
No, it's given me the creeps.
Yeah, so the jackpot is basically cascading crises, starting with a pandemic and,
over
and then environmental and overheating of the planet and all of these things that we're in right now. And again, he wrote it in 2014. Yeah, we were still in some of that,
but
he basically projected us to right where we are now.
Yeah.
I think that might be the only part of the book where he touches on, like, a little bit of an ethical issue, because he specifically talks about how Wilf really struggles with being able to go to the past, but
and
not do
like
anything about it.
Yep.
And, like, reconcile that with being...
Wilf can't, but Lobear can. Well,
only to an extent.
I just want to ruin the second book for y'all.
Oh, do it.
Connor's president. Not Connor. Burton is president.
Oh,
what?
I was going to say.
President of which?
Of the United States. They're a
in
corporation. In the stub.
Because
they
buy off everything. Right.
Yeah, they save Gonzalez from being assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And their little corporation, fed money from the future, basically takes over the world.
Oh, my God. Then why does
I
kind of
like
does
that.
Burton get to be president and not Flynn?
Flynn doesn't want to be president,
which would make Flynn an excellent president.
Yeah.
But that means
some of those
politics. But when Wilf is talking about it to Flynn,
he feels helpless.
But also, like, it's kind of like, you know, reconciling privilege or white guilt. It's like there's nothing I cannot make myself be in the past, and there's nothing I can do to fix the past. But I would say that Lobear, even if she's trying to fix something, something else is going to happen. We always know that.
Probably. I've got a quote from the book about this. We'll get there. Last couple pieces of tech. Everything is 3D printed in this world.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they literally 3D
except for the trailer.
Except for the trailer, because it's an antique.
Mm-hmm.
But everything is 3D printed. You need something, 3D print it. Fab it, make it, print it. It was kind of cool that that's maybe the way we'll get in the near future. I want a whatever, bam, print it out.
But 3D printed with, like, bio tech.
Some of it's bio,
yeah.
Yeah. Fascinating.
I don't know. I think that's some of the genius of the writing in that it's not so far flung into the science fiction realm that people are dismissive of it, like kind of like what you were talking about with having the nightmares, because it's kind of, you know, that whole VR, like, this is part of the stuff that we have now, this technology.
It's
like,
right
it's
there.
Not a stretch. Like, my husband was, I complain sometimes about sci-fi. He says, like, they never go far enough in the future for the tech that they are proposing is possible.
Yeah.
And so you watch movies like, you know, Back to the Future, you know, and we're already
past
10 years past it, you know, or even you know, like Star Trek.
And we still don't have
indicators. Where's
we still don't have those hoverboard skateboard.
I don't need that.
hover
we have the opposite problem with Newitz's book, where they're so far in the future, but the tech isn't there. It's like not far enough. So I think, again, in Gibson writing 10 years earlier than we're at right now, genius. To have hit the technology at a level that is to use Vygotsky's term, it's right in our zone of proximal development. We can see it. We can just about reach that technology.
Mm-hmm. It probably even exists. We, the plebs, just don't know about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, probably.
You're going to give me more nightmares.
Sorry. So
here's
it's like Google Glass.
It
Google
is.
Google Glass was
yeah.
created 15 years ago.
Yep.
Right.
Ugh. Well, here's, so this, I think I just realized when you were talking about this, one of the reasons why this book freaks me out. So I love Margaret Atwood, one of my favorite authors, but one of the reasons why I love her is because she disturbs the hell out of me. And this is very, you know, satirical near realism that's very disturbing. And I know that he's supposed to be the prophet of steampunk, but I'm just like, I feel like he's just the prophet of
the present.
Yeah.
And Margaret Atwood make a great
I wonder if they've met. They've got to have met. They should co-write a book together. It probably, I'd have to go get, like,
probably kill yourself.
Help. Yeah, it'd be bad. It'd be very bad. But, I mean, bad in such a way where you're really analyzing. I felt I was analyzing a lot my impact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would I do in this kind of post-apocalyptic universe, in this world where you're having to do things that are adjacent to legal?
Mm-hmm.
Gray area in order to keep your family alive.
Some drugs.
In a world where drugs are prohibitively expensive. You know, they're pulling out thousands and thousands
$5,000, $8,000, $10,000 for
a pill.
Yeah. Which is kind of there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, some medications, and, you know, there's no talk of things like insurance or anything like that. So, you know, this world, it already
the world is disintegrating.
This is what it already is like. People don't have health insurance. For them, it is $5,000 a pill.
Yeah.
Like, this is now.
Yeah, it is. He hit it right on. How about Hefty Mart? Should we go to Hefty Mart and pick up our drugs?
Is it Amazon? Walmart?
It's Walmart plus Starbucks is what I saw.
Hefty Mart, oh my God, yeah.
Yeah. It's this ubiquitous store of everything.
Don't you get your CT scan at Hefty Mart? I was like, what?
Have any of you been to Europe and seen, like, the Walmart of Europe? It's called Tesco.
Yes, I've been in Tesco.
So you know a Tesco. I feel like Hefty Mart is more like a Tesco.
Because,
you know, Tesco's got the bookstore and the coffee shop and the thing. Mm-hmm. It's like
One-stop shop.
The only thing they're missing is furniture. So it's like IKEA, Tesco, and Amazon.
Oh, if we push them all together.
I can't help but laugh and think of By and Large from Wally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And, of course, my favorite piece of tech, thylacines.
Not Wheelie Boy?
Marsupial wolves. If you have not looked at a video of a thylacine, there are videos because they went extinct early in the 20th century. Look at a video of a thylacine. They're scary as anything.
Like you're talking about Tasmanian tigers?
Tasmanian wolves.
Okay.
Yeah. And their mouths open like...
Yeah, Tasmanian tigers.
That's what Flynn called them, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Crazy. I love that they brought them back in this book. Okay.
Just for shits and giggles, they brought them back here.
Yeah.
Because why not?
Decor.
Because what could possibly go wrong with a thing that can open its mouth 3 feet wide?
Like, they're actually quite nice. You're like, I don't know about that.
Yeah, no. Any other tech we missed? Can I think?
We didn't talk much about the haptics. I mean,
oh, you want to talk about haptics quick?
I want to talk about the haptics. I thought...
I think we can talk about the haptics more when we did the series, but...
Yes.
It's worth mentioning.
I thought in the book, it took me a while to figure out what they were talking about. And then seeing the series helped me understand more. But, I mean, that kind of technology already, you know, exists.
Yeah, surgical implants for soldiers.
Yeah, in a remedial form, like direct communication... goggles that can allow you to see something present in one lens and something else in another lens, but this is at like a neurological level. Really cool.
So the soldiers can feel what everybody else is feeling in their troop, and they know it instantaneously.
Well, and that's the kind of technology that I'm pretty sure does exist, but we do not know about it because it involves a lot of human testing that is so not illegal.
Well, that's like Black Mirror shit.
It is.
Because Black Mirror touched on all of that stuff. In like the second season.
And we will learn about the genesis of haptics in the series when we talk about the series.
Yes. Haptics Harmon. She is ready.
That is future tech brought back to the stub.
Mm. So. That's not good.
Well, and it's they talked about Flynn, you know, curbing her phone. Like, so you think about the technology of being so much more. I mean, it's her communication. It's part of her.
Her phone is everything.
The phone is everything, and it's kind of like what we do.
But then it's also completely tracked by the government. Yes. If something happens to it, you have to.
Right, which they acknowledge too. They're like fully aware.
Your funny phone. Do they notice that mine's funny?
Yeah.
Which is it? Doesn't I got that to mean? You know, it was made illicitly on the black market, and it's not really the one that
it's
you
like
were
a burner
issued.
Phone.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's harder.
It was fapped. It's printed.
My wife is Adelina. Mabel Warren Hagstrom.
Well, if you're gonna make a wish, wish for some damn money, will ya?
Deleted.
word processor of the gods. Identify some dramatic and well-written passages. Do people have some? If not, I can just pass my computer around and we can read the ones that I pulled.
I struggled with this because I was listening to it primarily in audiobook, so there were parts where I was like, ooh, that was really good.
Mm-hmm. I did too, so I then went on the internet and found quotes from the book.
Smart. Yeah, you should go for it.
I think the most, like, beautifully descriptive part that I liked was when they're going through Central Park in the future. That I liked. But
that's what I put as my fan favorite moment.
Okay, read it then.
That's not there.
Oh, dang.
I just put that as a moment. I didn't find the page. If you want to look to that page.
You want to dig around? Well, do you want to read a different?
Yeah, I've got a bunch. So we just pass them around if that's okay. And you can pick one.
Yeah,
you
we have different voices. Sounds good.
So now in her day, he said, they were headed into androgenic, systemic, multiplex, seriously bad shit. Like she sort of already knew, figured everybody did, except for people who still said it wasn't happening, and those people were mostly expecting the second coming anyway. That's Flynn talking about the jackpot. So that's that one.
The jackpot parts are really cool.
The double dick dude in the beginning was also.
We have a cringy place. We have a cringy part.
Oh, God.
So we'll get there. Beautiful.
All right. The double dick was beautiful.
So I only had like four or five quotes there.
Ooh, I like it. Are you from the future, Mr. Netherton? Not exactly, he said. I'm in the future. That would result from my not being here. But since I am, it isn't your future. Here.
That's great.
That's a good one. Confusing. I'll get out.
You guys keep talking. I'm still reading.
Well, I think that's what I liked. Is just, there was that never-ending paradox of are we now, are we then, are we now, are we then?
And never and the then, twain shall meet.
And exactly. And then the thought of so many, every time you come back, a new stub is created.
I'm not sure it's every time you come back. It's when you make contact with, when you open that gateway. It creates a new stub.
And then
but I don't think it's every time.
Interacting with that thing.
In my head, it's
in
like
in physics,
Loki.
It would be every time.
If you've seen the Loki TV show, like there's the sacred timeline, and then it branches off. And then each of the stubs can branch off as
the idea
well.
The idea in physics is that it branches off at every single decision point.
Exactly.
For every single person, every single entity.
Which is overwhelming.
Yeah, which is. So this is a little bit more manageable.
Because
they create a single stub, and it's a proprietary thing that they cultivate.
It is a proprietary thing.
That is so odd.
So I assume that this is Flynn asking this question. Lobear knows how to fix history. It isn't history yet here. She knows in large part what really happened here. But now the two have diverged, will continue to. The divergence can be steered to some extent, but only very broadly. No guarantee of what will ultimately produce. She's trying to stop the jackpot? Ameliorate it at best. We are very much already in it here. She hopes, as I do, that the system in which she operates can be avoided in this continuum. Which is still part of that kind of mind-bending kind of stuff that I used to struggle with it.
I guess,
watching the Terminator, I'm like, hang on.
Well, what are the implications of fixing the future in one timeline?
Okay.
The other timeline still exists, and the world still sucks. So I don't. It's really interesting to think about.
Futuristic timeline still is missing 80% of the human population.
Mm-hmm. Right, but are we going to have more population? Just to think about all those branches and where they go and what it means.
Would that branch that they are in? The future branch that reached back into this and made the stub, even be the future anymore? If you make it so the jackpot doesn't happen?
Well, yes, because there's a distinctive breakoff point. Like it snapped, so it's its own thing. So it no longer affects the original time.
It would be more of a future than the future.
Was there nothing else?
Well, there's that Eras one.
He rated a few.
That's a one on by Will Fund Eras.
Well, I wonder, too, just a little bit about, like, storage capacity
in the server.
In the server, like how?
Well, and then is any of it even real?
And well, then, but that's also part of the. I feel like that feeds into the jackpot because storing data is so
energy intensive,
environmentally friendly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I wonder, like, does each time you create a stub, are you creating the entire known existence? Or
it seems like it.
Are you just creating
this limited space
of what you interacted with? So would there
be great question?
A lot of the stubs would be very almost
it's hard
identical.
Which adds some interesting depth to Lobeer, assuming that she has.
Because she exists in the past too.
Right.
It's Griff.
Yeah.
Which I didn't understand, but
she survives the jackpot.
Uh-huh.
And
it's changed.
Not just from the jackpot.
Right.
Like she is.
Because she'd be pretty old.
Yeah. I kind of linked her to someone like in the Terraformers, mm-hmm. where it's just like they were one of the people who was lucky enough to like continue to inhabit mm-hmm. different bodies and continue to live.
Oh, that's interesting.
Or change their body
just keeps
enough.
Keeps jumping, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. We're able to get an implant enough, that allowed them to survive, like continue
enough technological
to,
intervention to keep her yeah. ticking for 100 years, basically.
Jeez.
That's an interesting concept.
Because the implants, right?
Yeah.
Eras are conveniences, particularly for those who never experience them. We carve history from totalities beyond our grasp. Bolt labels on the result, handles. Then speak of the handles as though they were things in themselves.
I remember that part.
All right. Well, we can jump to the fan humanoid moment, which is your favorite moment of the book.
We walked through the night and made it back to Castle Rock a little past 5 o'clock on Sunday morning, the day before Labor Day. We'd only been gone 2 days, but somehow the town seemed different, smaller.
Mm-hmm. Natalie and I shared the same one, so...
Yeah, or the birds.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so either when... This is after Wilf tells Flynn about the jackpot, and then she asks to come and walk more around London, and they go through Hyde Park, which looks nothing like Hyde Park right now, but rather like a conglomerate of all the species they could save, which then they enhanced dramatically. And I just, I want to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which they do portray some of that in the series, okay. not in as much detail.
Yeah. And then my other favorite part of the book was, well, I listened to it, so was when they were in the Parliament of Birds, him and Ash speaking together, which, like, was the first part besides the jackpot part where I was like, now I'm, like, piecing more things mm-hmm. together about, like, why shit's so sketchy. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other favorite parts?
I loved when Connor got to experience
body.
The oh, yeah. peripheral for the first time. I was in tears. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. just going from this person who...
Destroyed person.
Well, before that he's a destroyed person, this very capable, very strong, mm-hmm. very...
Oh, yeah.
All of these things. And then life changes.
Shattered.
Doing what he loves... And what was he was trained to do, and is barely existing, and then being able to like, almost come back to the major leagues.
Mm-hmm. To inhabit a real body.
To inhabit a real body who can do all of the things that it could do that most people still can't.
Mm-hmm.
It was really beautiful to see that transformation mm-hmm. of his interpretation of value. Yeah.
And when we get to the series, Connor's just 10 times more tragic than you even can imagine from this book. So hard. I love the portrayal of London. Like when that moment when they realize there aren't really people, like all the people are projections or
peripherals.
Whatever. Yeah. yeah. And you're just like, oh, there's not people. Like that was a huge moment for me.
Mm-hmm. So,
I like how there is a specific culture that it gets centered around. So as an example or comparison, thinking about movies like Blade Runner or Firefly, where a dominant culture has become the pervasive, like Mandarin in Blade Runner, that a society like that values propriety, like London. I don't know. I like that flavor. I like that kind of touch on a story, kind of influences how the characters behave or the civility of villains, which makes them, to me, even more villainous. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about, you know,
just Cutler Beckett. Just a nice, proper man.
Yes, like Cutler Beckett from Pirates of the Caribbean. You know, he just so prim and proper and welcome, come and have tea while I
murder
you. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah. So I like, and just setting it in it, putting an English cultural background on that.
Mm-hmm. I liked it. I think I really enjoyed the whole world building of this book because it was so disturbing. But my favorite pieces were, especially while listening it on audiobook, was the descriptions of things like the scrubbers and things that I was like, God, I wish we had those right now. We totally need those.
Yeah.
Or the assembler, like all the technology descriptions, just enough to where you get information you need, but then you can totally picture them. And the way that they are the big buildings in future London also function as scrubbers for
atmosphere cleaners.
I was like, why aren't we doing this already?
Yeah.
So cool.
Because we're too dumb.
I know. We just keep building giant-ass buildings, but no scrubbers.
Yeah. Yep. Other favorite parts? So we can move on to the less favorite parts.
I really liked the tattoos.
The moving tattoos, the animated
tattoos.
So cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, they run and they hide. And
they have their own personalities. Uh-huh. I wonder if, like, sometimes they give away what people are trying to conceal. Like, it's an
emotion. They show your emotion.
Additional layer to communication.
Yeah.
I like it.
Pretty cool.
Any of you all know what a sundown town is?
Yes, sir, we do.
Well, this is a sundown county. If I had found you pissing in my woods like animals after dark, it would have been my sworn duty to hang every single one of you from them trees. It's not sundown yet.
Okay, we got to push
404, on. Page not found. Poorly written passages. Lost in space. Things that are simply too far out to be believed, even in sci-fi. And then we can move on to Lovecraft, which are cringy and weird. And we also have asexual reproduction, which is just awkwardly racy parts of the book. So any of those pieces people want to share?
Double dick, dude.
DDD?
Unnecessary.
It's 3Ds.
The frog? Yes, I was really confused. What character was that? I got distracted by the double dick.
I did too. It was in the beginning.
In the beginning.
And then it was also towards the end.
Wasn't it the guy?
Oh my
God.
Was it Al-Habib?
Al-Habib
is a double dick frog.
Because remember him and
he had a perf.
Double dickage is the name of that chapter. I can't get over it.
See?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. But she's patrolling and she sees him take his pants off.
Exactly.
And she's like, what the fuck is that?
She
even says like the second one is unnecessary because it's just like a small little
flaccid thing.
Well, that sounds like a cringy part.
But he makes a reprise towards the end.
Yeah,
he's the bad guy.
Oh, I love it.
Why he's got a double dick. It's like, a dude who's got like a massive truck with balls hanging off the back.
His husband has that.
He's an ex for a reason.
When I buy my next minivan, I'm buying a vagina to hang off the back of it. Metal, so it makes sparks on the grill.
You know what? That would be refreshing.
I just want to see how many rednecks try and kill me over
the
that.
V-van.
Well, now
that's inappropriate. I'm like, you got testicles hanging off your truck, dude.
So now I'm picturing, like, you know, the Dodge Ram emblem as the uterus and ovaries.
Dude.
Oh. It has to
We have digressed. We have diverged. Decision was made, and it went.
Yeah. So that was definitely.
So the thing that for me that was too that hurt the book, honestly, for me, was It's a mystery. You're supposed to be able to have enough clues, enough information, aside from the two dongs, to solve the mystery. They do not give you enough information to solve the mystery in this book until it's revealed at the end. That is a huge problem. It's not the way you're supposed to write a mystery. No. Gibson broke the mystery, and that's the leap the shark moment for me. It's like, oh, here's the big reveal. Here's the people who you should have been looking for all along, but we never told you they even existed.
Yeah. Well, they told us about Al-Habib.
Now, with any information, there's no information in that chapter that I remember that pointed to him being the murderer.
It's just going to break.
Yeah.
I mean, I just thought from the beginning that it was probably Deirdre.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because I was like, yeah, okay, that dude that was having sex with Alita killed her, but I feel like there's some weird sister stuff happening.
Yeah, but he had not any clues, though.
No, just that she was a bitch, and so I was like, yeah, you probably killed her because you're a vapid and don't care if your sister dies.
Poor Alita.
Yeah.
I think because of that, because there wasn't anything to keep you thinking about why you were in that world, I just got more engaged in the world itself,
right,
and kind of forgot that I was supposed to be
immersion,
figuring out
who
killed Alita, even though, you know, you talk about, you know, Wolf's like, oh, it's my sister, we're looking for my sister. Because it's not, I'm looking for my sister's killer. You kept forgetting.
Yeah.
So yeah, I didn't feel, when you were at the beginning talking about how it was a mystery that you were solving, I was like, wait, what was I trying to, what were you trying
mystery?
To figure
yeah,
out from the beginning?
They,
it was like, oh yeah.
That's because, the whole reason the book happened.
Because, because Flynn saw that murder happen and they were trying to figure out why someone was trying to kill her after she witnessed it. It's like, oh yes, I totally forgot about that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was poorly written mystery then, yes, for sure.
I thought Wilf's fledgling infatuation with Flynn was a little strange.
Unnecessary.
Forced.
Yeah, it was forced.
I think that it's a little bit forced, but it builds to his character because he's always having inappropriate relationships, which is what Ash says to him.
Even when he's an iPad
Ash on is
a
like,
stick.
Ash is like, stop being such a narcissist. Mm-hmm. Not everything is about you.
True.
Flynn doesn't like you. Stop.
Let
just stop.
Yeah.
Just stop.
Fair. I think that's good. There was the people on the pile of trash with the tattoos and the skin cancers. I thought that might fit into Lovecraft, but maybe not. And then Alita, who periodically skins herself and displays her skins and regrows
Deirdre.
A skin. Deirdre?
Deirdre.
Was it Deirdre?
Deirdre?
Whichever one. That's probably maybe the biggest clue.
Yeah, that was weird.
Skins herself and displays her skin on the wall with the tattoos. I thought that was pretty funky.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can't imagine how uncomfortable that would be.
I'd be shocked.
Your work is so...
I have to take a quick break.
Oh, God. Your work is crap.
Then we can go into the end game, which is crazy plot twists and the critical reception of the book.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger. No, Will Robinson. Danger.
Intruder alert. Intruder alert. Strange and crazy plot twists. For me, it was really that Lobier and Griff are the same person, but they're not, because one exists in the stub and one exists in the regular future. Did Lobier need to exist in the past as Griff? It was interesting. I was just not sure.
Well, no, Griff will not become Lobier now.
Right.
Lobier is Griff.
Correct.
When so. I missed that entirely. When was that disclosed?
Towards the end.
So when Flynn is trying to figure out, like, how did they even get connected? Mm-hmm. It turns out
that Lobier contacted herself.
Lobier contacted herself and was like, hey, I know you. I can't tell you how I know you.
Right.
But let's work together.
Let's hook up and figure this stuff out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, wow. Okay. It was interesting.
Okay.
Apparently not central to the story.
But so Lobier created the stub.
No.
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 We
the
don't
stub
know.
Was already created.
We don't know who created this stub.
Okay.
Or why they created this stuff. That's the mystery. That's not addressed.
That is true, because at the very beginning they talk about the economy of stubs,
mm-hmm,
and like how people in the future can make money off of
yes,
stubs.
Which is the series, which is why we need to have a second episode, not just the series. Because that is
disturbing. Because they also, there's like a mention of like, well, this stub's just going to be a dead end, which made me think mm-hmm. like everyone's just going to die. So they're just using this as like literally extract, extract, extract.
Yes. The mining, the resource mining out of it. Yeah. No, it's, again, when we do the series, the people who wrote the series just dive so deep into the moral and ethical implications of all of this stuff. It's totally
Which is why love is so creepy for me.
Love is a monster.
Any other strange and crazy plot twists? It was pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
I think kind of what Britt was saying earlier about that there was still a mystery to solve. Like, I know that was central to the plot. Like, the entire
but it suddenly
thing.
Came back at the end. Like, oh, there was a mystery.
I forgot that that was,
I was supposed to care about
it. And it took them no time to figure out that they were not who they said they were. Wilf and Flynn and her in whatever's body at that party. Like, you're the bad person. Oh, yeah. Come with me. You're being tortured now.
Yeah. It
took no time to discern that at all. Yeah.
It was almost like the book came about a party that wasn't really rememberable.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
We watched as the bombs shattered the second comet into a million pieces of ice and rock that burned harmlessly in our atmosphere and lit up the sky for an hour.
All right. Cultural impact. We already talked about the impact of Neuromancer and Gibson in general, but for this one, Peripheral was positively received by The Guardian, according to GQ's Zach Baron. GQ. Like many Gibson books, The Peripheral is basically a noirish murder mystery wearing a cyberpunk leather jacket and, after an uncharacteristically dense first 100 pages, a super enjoyable read, though perhaps less so when you consider just how accurate Gibson can be when he's thinking about what might come next. Because, according to The Peripheral, what is coming next is, to borrow Gibson's phrase again, well, fucked. The Sydney Morning Herald noted an ultimate lack of narrative cohesion, but said that the book was still dense with imaginative technological inventions and societal extrapolations, not least on capitalism, government surveillance, and retro third world colonialism. The Irish Times wrote that it was a formidable novel and one that boasts just about the only plausible depiction of time travel in recent fiction, but it does suffer from slow pacing and a flat final act climax. Mm-hmm. The Financial Times gave it a mixed review, calling the twin narratives complex and tangled, but overly drawn out over the book's nearly 500 pages. The Verge said the book was a smart, nuanced twist on time travel and praised how detail integrated more into the characters' lives than his other recent series. NPR gave the book a positive review. Toronto Star said it could be difficult to keep up with the book, but it was fast-paced and chock-full of fascinating speculations into not only what the future will look like, but how it will work. Again, I picked this book because I think it's really smart. All right, all about David Bowie. Because those of you new to the podcast, I'm a David Bowie fan. There always has to be a David Bowie impact or connection in sci-fi. There is a book, a group called Vampire Disco Club, and their first debut album was called New Romance. It is a play on David Bowie's single Modern Love from the album Let's Dance, but it is themed on Neuromancer from Cyberpunk. So there's some Bowie there. Gibson did meet Bowie at some point, according to The New Yorker. Neuromancer was also the inspiration for several music albums. I played the Billy Idol's Neuromancer, which is Cyberpunk, is the album. U2's Zooropa is based on Neuromancer, and U2 at one point wanted to scroll the entire text of the novel behind them as they were performing their Zooropa tour.
That's a copyright challenge. Did you really need the whole text?
There's also a book called Strange Stars, How Science Fiction and Fantasy Transformed Popular Music, which focuses on Bowie, but also explores the cross-pollination of these two artists. In another of Gibson's books, Iduru, there's a character called the Music Master who is David Bowie, all the way down to the different colored irises. And they have a penchant for long flowing coats. And then a quote from Gibson, "I just remember I wanted to write something that would read the way Diamond Dog sounded." That's William Gibson on writing Neuromancer. So, pew pew time. New pews, you want to go first? So, just for those new to the podcast, we rate each of these science fiction books on a 1 to 5 pew pew scale. So that would be, a 5 would be pew pew, pew pew, pew pew, pew pew, pew pew.
You may also have the oxygen for that.
Yeah, you may also do a half a pew. So you may do a pew pew pew.
1.5.
If it's a pew.
Can
you
go up higher an octave?
So, new people, you want to start with your pew pews?
And explain a little short.
Liz, yeah, why you're pew pewing that way?
Pew pew, pew pew, pew pew, pew pew.
So I'm four pew pews. Four pew pews. Or eight pews.
Eight, correct. And because I really liked the world that it introduced, the mystery part wasn't necessary. The world was amazing.
It's all about the world.
And being able to really be a part of and live in that world, as confusing as it was for the first 100 pages, was absolutely amazing. And you can take it so many different places.
Wonderful.
Pew pew. Marina. Pew pew. Pew pew.
Three pew pews.
Three pews. Six pews. Three pew pews. Six pews.
I think that I would benefit from reading it again, because I felt like I spent so much energy just trying to decode that first part, like trying to get drawn in. Because sometimes when you're reading a book, it's like the first chapter should grab you and then draw you in for the rest of it. And I still felt like I spent so much time just trying to get my sea legs and figure out what was going on. The concept, it's super fascinating. So I think that, you know, as an overall, I probably would have given it more stars. But for me personally, it took a little while for it to, you know, for me to get reeled in.
Pew pew, pew pew, pew pew, pew.
Okay. 3.5.
3.5.
Sorry, kind of 3.5. Like Liz said, I loved the world. I didn't need him to grab me in the first chapter. Because I am such, when I read a book, the world comes to life in my brain. I do not need a lot of information. And so even though it was confusing, I really just immersed myself, which was even easier with the audiobook, which is what I used to listen to it. But I am a fan of mystery. And so the entire book, I was like, so, you know, is it Lobier? Did Lobier do it? Is it Lev? Was it Deidre? Like, who was it? And then...
Left completely hanging.
Well, I remember looking at my phone and I was like, 40 minutes left. I was like, what the fuck? And the party happens. And then I'm like, 10 minutes left? Okay, how are they going to wrap up this book? And I just thought, I mean, this kind
of... It's like he forgot.
It's like he forgot, but also, like, I thought the ending was just kind of, eh.
Bloop.
Because it's like Flynn and Flynn and Wilf. Yeah, Flynn and Wilf are just like, and we did it, and you're rich, and we can just be friends.
Ta-da!
And I was like, that was a stupid ending. Yeah. So I'm big on good endings, and I felt disappointed that the ending did not fit the rest of the book, because I thought the rest of the book was genius.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go next, and then you can go and then lead into the next book.
Perfect.
I'm going to go pew, 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 pew. Also 3.5 for the exact same reasons as Natalie. I will say the second reading after watching the series, way better.
Ooh,
like,
okay.
I understood what was happening from the jump, and I was like, I forgot the mystery, honestly, because it is like a vestigial thing, vestigial member.
It's a bonus penis? Double digging.
It's a bonus penis. But totally got in, understood the characters, understood the tech, like, got it. And you could just go. A second read, way better than a first read. But I brought the book. I feel like 3.5 is maybe a little disappointing for having brought it. But I would have done Neuromancer had I thought about it more. but I was just so enamored with this series that I had to bring back this book. But Neuromancer is a better book than this book. Okay. It's all about the mystery. Maybe we'll do it later.
So I did 3.5 PPUs. I'm not going to say them all. And the reason why I gave the extra 0.5 was because of how excited I am to continue to get into the series. And I actually want to, at some point, revisit the book and read it again. Because I felt very lost. Rena was talking about, you know, having to really get your sea legs. I don't feel like I got any sea legs reading the book. And this is my primary genre, sci-fi fantasy. So I really struggled with it. Went back and reread chapters. And then also was reading it, listening to it, and watching the series at the same time. Because it just...
It's a lot.
Yeah. It was a lot. Maybe watching the series in addition didn't help. Because then it would just did a different stuff. And I was like, wait a second, that was not in the book. Oh, dang it. And then I went back. I was like, that's because it's a series. Duh, Brittany. But yeah, 3.5. I think it's really amazing. It's probably one of the most intricate and futuristic worlds that disturbed me that I've ever read. But yeah, the part that just I could never get a grasp on was like, what the hell we were even there for? And it was that murder. And then you're like, later get reminded that it was for a murder. Like, ah, okay. Though the whole scene in the book, I forgot to mention this, that I really liked was the description of the little bots going into her.
And eating her up, dissolving her.
Oh my God. And as she fell off the ledge and felt she disintegrated until there was nothing
was really
on the ground.
Beautiful writing, but also made me want to vomit.
That was my favorite, most well-written but also disturbing passage because I could pictured it. I was like, oh my God. It was just like I was watching her body, then nothing.
Yeah. The thing is so amazing about him is he really does use the minimum number of words, but really paints great visuals or gives you the space, I think Natalie's point, gives you the space to see it. It gives you enough and you can just hang cloth on it to dress the body.
Oh, yeah. But there was no body.
How about the candy cane guns? We never talked about the candy cane guns.
Oh, I was going to say, I thought that was a unnecessary moment.
Yes.
For her to, like, come in the bar and be like, pew! And she's like, it's okay. He was just a peripheral. And it's like, what? No. You just scared everybody else. Mm-hmm. And then, but that gets into more ethical issues of like, are peripherals
people?
Real people?
Oh,
or just expensive
property. Do androids dream of electric sheep?
Yes.
Yeah.
They do. Well, so thank you all for listening. If you're still interested in joining us in our journey, the next book will be
Much
Her
smaller.
Land. Oh, yes. It's more of a novella. It's Her Land by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, which is a feminist utopia, just to give a little teaser. And it was written in the 1800s. And it's amazing. Charlotte Perkins Gilman has written multiple books. Her Land is one of three that's not really a series. They're all individual standing novellas, but they're in part of a seemingly similar world, part of the same universe. So really fun, and I'll be kind of taking the lead on that because feminist utopias, period piece writings are my jam.
Yeah.
So I will be happily talking about Charlotte as though she were my homegirl in the present.
All right. Thank you, everybody. New journeyers, really appreciate having you here.
Thank you.
Bye.
Oh, I have to say it.
Bye.
In the basement, where the nerds reside, we gather round with a wicked stride. With our books in hand, we start to dive into dystopian worlds that come alive.